I'm Cliff Gooding, Grateful Alcoholic. I've been sober since August 15th of 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. Hello, Georgia! Yeah. I was a little worried at halftime. I thought I'd about to have a whole room full of newcomers for a while. I'm grateful I don't, that's for sure. So, I had to make some notes. And by the way, thanks for the goodie bag. It had a notepad in it so I could make my notes on. So, I want to thank the committee for inviting Lori and I to come this weekend and be here with y'all, be a service. We're very grateful for that. I want to thank my friend Jeff for calling me and extending me the invitation to be here. My good friend Randy for being such a great host. Julia for being such a great host to my wife. And really, what I need to tell you is we're just so grateful to be here. As expression of that gratitude, I got on a plane on Friday and flew to Georgia. You know, gratitude is a great thing, but it's an action word where I come from. You can be grateful all you want, but until you do something about it, it's just another thought I had, you know. And so I'm really grateful to be here. I have chaired several conventions and committees and the Alcoholics Anonymous. I've chaired our state conference. And what I can tell you about service work and Alcoholics Anonymous is this. Alcoholics are the upper crust of the mentally ill. And you work on a couple of committees and you're thinking, well, I think they're more down in the pudding than the crust, really. But I'm going to tell you, this convention has gone up effortlessly, you know. And I want to thank Jim and his committee, the people that work the literature tables, the people that greeted at the doors, the people that work the registration desks, people who hosted upstairs in the hospitality suites, and everybody who had anything to do with this committee. My hats are off to you because you've done a heck of a job, and it's a wonderful place this weekend. So thank you. I'm going to say, Lori and I flew out here on Friday, and there was the flight attendant. We just hit cruising altitude, and the flight attendant came on, and she said, we have somebody on this flight that has an extreme allergy to peanuts. So we will not be serving any nuts on this flight. Well, I heard some kids groan, but I saw a couple grown men almost getting fist fights about it, you know. Lori grabbed me by the arm and pulled me over. She said, let's not tell them about your extreme allergy. What do you think, pal, huh? I thought that was a good idea, based on the earlier reactions, you know. We were at an event in Oklahoma City. It wasn't an AA event. It was just a big, Lori was on the board of suicide prevention, and we were at a big whoop-de-doo, and there's probably a couple thousand people there, and it was a dinner, and then they honored all these people for contributions to the community. And Lori was on the board, so we get a couple of tables, so we have like 20 people there. And, you know, I always invite some of my guys, she invites some of her gals, and we just invite some earth people, too, you know, to come in and just be part of, friends of ours. And I invite a friend of mine, always do, and he's not an Alcoholics Anonymous, but he knows I'm sober, and he always brought a date this particular year. And he always tells them before he comes, he says, now listen, you need to know Cliff's allergic to alcohol, he doesn't drink. Well, wouldn't you know, she got parked right next to me. Now, at this event, they serve wine, cocktails. You know, it's no big deal. The problem has been removed. But you know how it is when you're at one of those gatherings, a lot like here tonight. You know, I love it when we come to meetings of alcoholics and all like this. Everybody talking, nobody listening. I love that, don't you? It's like the bars, man, you know. But we're at this deal, and you know how it is when you're sitting down, everybody's talking, and there's always a lull in the conversation. We're talking, you know, everybody's talking, then there's a lull in the conversation. And she leans over to me, she says, I understand you don't drink. I said, no, I don't drink. And conversation took off again, picked up, you know, and there's another lull in the conversation. And she leaned over, she said, not at all. And I said, no, no, not at all. Now get a little edgy now, David, you know. And the conversation carried on, and she leaned over again, she said, well, just exactly what would happen. If you had, say, like a glass of wine. And I thought, well, she did ask. So, I said, imagine this. You come to. You don't know where you are. You look around, you don't know where your wallet is. You don't know where your car is. You can't find your car keys. Her eyes are getting big, you know. And I said, you look down the hallway and your clothes are strung all the way down the hall. She says, oh my God. She said, if you took a drink, that would happen to you. I said, no, ma'am. If I took a drink, that happened to you is what would happen. My people. She didn't ask no more questions that night. I'm going to tell you that. I know my job here tonight's to talk and your job is to listen. I need to be done with my job before you're done with yours, so let's get after here. So thanks again for having me. I want to say hello to my good friend Dick A., who I've known for a number of years, and I'm so grateful to see Dick tonight. Lori and I hosted Dick and Barbara 12, 14 years ago in Oklahoma, and so good to see you. Thank you, my friend, for being here, for your service. Billy, thank you for your service and everybody in service here. So I got up. And I was checking my emails, and I know football's a big deal. It's a big deal where I come from too. And I was checking my emails, and yes, in Stillwater this weekend, it's homecoming weekend, and there's always a video that comes out. We have a big deal, a homecoming in hoops, and they have a big deal at Gallagher Iba Arena, the Madison Square Garden of the Midwest, and it's a big deal. And all the house, you know, the fraternities and sororities, and everybody gets there. It's jam packed. You got to get there early to get a seat, and it's a big deal. The big walk around and float decorations, and thousands of people come to Stillwater this weekend for homecoming. It's a big deal. And I got on this morning, I was looking at the homecoming and hoops video, and I was watching it. As I began to watch that, I began to remember what it was like for me to be there as a kid when I started college. I was 17 years old, and I remember getting there, and I would look at that video, and I would think about When I was on that campus and when they had those events there when I was there, and how much I wanted to go, how much I wanted to be there. And, you know, I just couldn't go. I just couldn't. And the reason I couldn't go is I was just so afraid of those people. You know, I'm just so afraid. You know, as long as I can remember, there's been this piece of me that's just, I don't know, it's just I don't feel good. You know, I'm not sick. I don't need to go to the doctor. But I just don't feel good, you know. It's like a best way to describe it, it's like if I had a jigsaw puzzle box and tipped it out, I got a piece missing. You know. I remember when my mama took me to kindergarten and I walked up to that little red schoolhouse and she opened the door and all those little kids' heads popped up. Now my mama had me there on time. I was early. But when I got there and I walked in that room and those little kids looked at me, I felt like I was 15 minutes late to the party. It was like they were reading some kind of books and they had all the answers and I don't even know what the questions are. This separateness, this different thing, Tammy described it so well last night. I need to go somewhere. I just need to be somewhere else. You know, wherever I am, that ain't good enough. And now when I could have described that for you at 6 years old going to kid, I couldn't told you that. I couldn't have verbalized that to you in any kind of words to tell you about this separateness. Corbin gave a great description of it. He talked about the wind blowing through him, you know. Whatever he tried to fill it up with, that missing piece. And I had no way to describe that. It's just that wherever I was, it just seemed like over there was better. You know, if I was a kid growing up and I'd make a commitment to be with Randy somewhere, you know, And I would get a call from somebody, David, and he would say, I'm having a party, so I'd go there instead of there because I'm sure it was better here, you know. And if somebody was Lisa was having a party down in Florida, I'd go there because that was probably a better deal. And I just, wherever I was never a comfortable place to be. And wherever I was always out of step. That's the way I felt my whole life. My whole life I felt that way. And when I was 11 years old, I had 11 years of continuous sobriety. And when I was 11 years old, when I was 11 years old, my brother gave me a drink of Country Club malt liquor. Yeah, me too, man. And I'm going to tell you, Country Club malt liquor on that day did exactly for me what alcohol is to do for a person of my type, a real live alcoholic. What it did when that alcohol poured on top of me, something happened. The book says that the doctor's opinion said men and women drink essentially because of the effect produced by alcohol. Later on that book it says that that feeling is so elusive, we'll chase it into the gates of insanity or death. And that feeling on that day with my brother drinking that beer, I can tell you what it was, the temperature was outside. I can tell you what it looked like. I can tell you what he was wearing. I can tell you the, what bird was chirping. I can tell you everything about that. Now my mama makes the best chocolate cakes I've ever had in my life. I hear she's making a chocolate cake. I'll drive from Oklahoma City to Hugo to have some, but it's that good. But I can't tell you the first time I ever had a piece of her chocolate cake. But I can remember that day I had that first drink of alcohol as clear as a bell, as clear as I'm seeing y'all out here. Absolutely remember that. And what I'm going to tell you on that day, that effect that it had on me, I just knew this, that I need to do that as often as I can. Because that 15 minutes I got caught up like that. And that puzzle piece that I had, it seemed like it fit right in the spot. And I'm going to tell you, just having that kind of a sensation, see, that's not what makes me alcoholic. That's a very accurate description of the spiritual malady that I suffer from. But that in and of itself does not describe alcoholism. And I think if you hear an Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, we're welcome. 2 days, bro, walking in here. I'm glad you're here, man. Congratulations, man. Welcome home. And you know, the description of that spiritual malady, not what makes me alcoholic. We heard Lori get up here today, never had a drink of alcohol in her life. Described the spiritual malady. Now, I didn't say she didn't need one. I just heard she didn't take one, you know. So, but that description of the malady, you know, a lot of people suffer from a spiritual malady, don't suffer from alcoholism. What makes me alcoholic? Well, I'll just give you, I can just summarize it into some stories that happened to me. Is that I would be home with Lori. And she would say at 6 o'clock at night on a Thursday, and she'd say, Cliff, I need a loaf of bread. I'm cooking dinner. It'll be ready at 7. And I would say, okay, I'll run get that. So I get in my car. I go to the homeland. I go in and get the loaf of bread. I'm coming out of my car. I run in to Randy. And Randy says, what are you doing? I said, Lori's cooking dinner. I got a loaf of bread. I got to take it home for it. It's ready at 7. He says, well, it's 6:15. Let's go over to the log in. We'll have a couple of beers. And then you can go home at 7. And I think 6:15, couple of beers, be home by 7. I can do that. And I leave with Randy and I go to the log in and we start drinking. Now, Sunday when I get home, everybody's mad at me. I mean, she's mad, the dog's mad, the cat's mad, the kids are mad, everybody's mad. Now, I don't know what you do if you walk into a situation like that, but what I like to do is get everybody in front of me. Because I don't want to end up in Utah at some kind of camp. You know, I just like to keep them in front of me. And I begin to swear to them that this will never happen again. And I'm going to tell you something. You can get a lie detector and you can put it on me. And I'll begin to swear. And I'm going to tell you this. I'll pass it every time. Not only that, I'll begin to tell you about how it really is Randy's fault. That if I hadn't run into Randy, I'd have got the bread, been home, we'd have had dinner, been a great night. And I'll tell her that. I'll begin to convince her that. And I begin to convince myself that's the truth. And that sometimes it pacifies them. On Monday, I get up and I go to work. And I'm in traffic. And I get down to work where I'm down there working. I'm busting my ass, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day down there killing it. And I begin to think about how they don't treat me right. They don't treat me right. They really don't respect the value I have in this company. I get in my car and I drive home and everybody at my house is still mad at me. And I don't know why. I apologized yesterday. And I might make it another 24, 48 hours, but somewhere in that time period, I'm going to find myself what the book describes and what you good people told me for the first time fit my life when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I become restless, irritable, and discontent again. And I'm going to end up back at a bar or somewhere drinking. And sometimes I'll go there intentionally, and sometimes I'll have a drink in my hand, and I won't even know how I got there. And I'll start again on a Wednesday, and on Saturday I'll come home. And the process for alcoholism looks something like this for me. It's obsession, spree, remorse, repeat. Over and over and over. Because when I start drinking, what I know now, what I didn't know then, is that something happens different to me. Something happens different to me than 90% of the population. When I take alcohol into my system, it sets off an allergy and a craving. It squeals up and we're going somewhere. You know, it's one of those Jekyll and Hyde, do some tragic kind of stuff kind of deals, you know? And then when I get done with the spree, I'm going to tell you how I'm never going to do this again. And the trouble is I do it over and over and over. And that's what makes me alcoholic. I can't drink and I can't not drink. That's absolutely. And I think if you're an Alcoholics Anonymous and if you're here tonight wondering am I alcoholic or not, you need to know what alcoholism is. You need to know what it is. Somebody needs to give you an adequate presentation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they need to describe to you this physical allergy and this mental obsession. Because I can tell you, I got that. But I had no clue about that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I liked to party. You know, I became a blackout. In high school, I became a daily drinker. The legal drinking age in Oklahoma at the time when I was growing up was like 21. But in my senior year, my buddy and I, we would go down to the Zippy Mart. We'd buy a 8-pack of Pony Millers. Some of y'all remember those. The legal age of drinking age in Oklahoma at that time, at 6:30 in the morning, was old enough to get your money on the counter. So we'd buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers, and we'd split them right down the middle. I'd have 6, and he'd have 2. And I'd get a cool buzz on, and I'd go to class, and you know, just that way. By the time I got to college, I was a blackout drinker. And I was one of those people that liked to sit wherever I was drinking and talk about those people over at Gallagher Arboretum and talk about why I couldn't be there and how stupid they were for doing that stuff. I am so separated from everybody. You know, I love how Corbin described that today, sitting at that table talking about everybody. Did you pour some liquor in me? By God, I'm the king of the show, you know. And that's how it was for me. I was a blackout drinker in college, and blackout drinking, I just thought that's what happened to people when they drank. You know, it's like, well, have you ever seen those shows like on the Discovery Channel or something? They'll be interviewing somebody, and it'll be like, Miss Smith, tell us what happened. And she said, well, I was sitting at home on Friday, and I woke up Sunday. I was at a Holiday Inn. I was abducted by aliens. And I'm thinking, they're not asking Miss Smith the right questions here, you know. The question ought to be, Miss Smith, what were you drinking Friday night? That really ought to be the questions, you know. But I just time traveled. I'd start over here with one group of people, and I'd end with a different group of people over here. I went to law school at the University of Oklahoma. I got in down there kind of by the skin of my teeth because I was out drunk the night before the law school acceptance exam and barely got in. And I made a firm resolution when I was in law school that first year. I said, I'm not going to drink for a full year. That's the worst year of my life. Really, you know. And I did really well. I was first in my class that first year. I was blessed or cursed, have you heard it? I got a tad of a photographic memory. If I look at something, generally I've got it. And it's the only way that saved me to go through law school. Because after that first year, you do the first year and you don't drink, what do you do at the end of the year? Celebrate, right? And so I started celebrating. Took my first hostage. At the end of when I graduated from law school, she petitioned the court. I developed this problem of going out on Thursdays, not coming home till Sundays. And when we graduated, she graduated from undergraduate and I graduated from law school. She had me served with divorce papers and the court set her free. And you know, that was okay for me. You know, that was perfectly all right with me because, see, she didn't understand. And I've got a list of reasons that I can tell you why it's your fault and why you don't understand. If you worked like I do and provided like I did, you know, it's all right for me to go have a drink every once in a while. I've got a litany of excuses I can give you to tell you why really it's your fault that I'm having to do all this anyway. And the court set her free. I got a good job in downtown Oklahoma City working in one of those big tall office buildings. And I can tell you, I've never been fired from a job. It's been suggested I find other employment, but I've never been fired. And we had a Christmas party that year, that first year there, and I went with a bunch of stiff people. They just were stiff, man. And I was kind of a fun guy, you know. And those silk stocking law firms, they just really weren't ready for me yet, you know. And I kind of thought, well, maybe I shouldn't drink at the Christmas party. And I just said, I'm just not going to drink at the Christmas party. And about 3:00, one of the secretaries came around and said, Cliff, I'm going to have a glass of wine. Would you like one? And I'm kind of like Roland Hazard, you know. The only time I ever said no to that question is if I misunderstood it. Yes, I would. Do you ever quit drinking and forget you forgot to quit? Yeah, I did that all the time. Yeah. I forgot I quit. And so I started drinking. I black out because that's what I do. And shortly after that, it was suggested I find another employment. And then, you know, what happened in that deal? I just began to pick them apart. You know, I began to talk about it in my mind. Because I like to do that, talk in my mind. I begin to think to myself, you don't really appreciate me anyway, you know. I mean, I'm third chair in these jury trials. I could do a lot better than these people. Now, I've never tried a case, but I'm pretty sure I could, you know. And I'm picking apart. I'm judging them, kind of like y'all are tonight. Anyway, I'm just... And the thing about alcoholics, you know, we'll lose a job and we'll get a better one. You know, and so I got a better one. I found another hostage, you know, and on our 1-year wedding anniversary, she served me divorce papers. That's how you know it ain't going good, by the way. Not at all, David. So I was in Norman one night. I was down there drinking on a Sunday night. It's a great night to drink if you're a drinker. On a Sunday night, I was at a bar down there. I've been drinking most of the afternoon and the evening. I went to the bathroom. I tell this story, have to get a little more detail for the ladies, because I've looked around here, talked to some of y'all this weekend, and there's some real ladies here today. I know none of you have ever been to a men's bathroom before, so I need to explain. And, well, you have, ma'am. I know that. But anyway, ladies, at men's restrooms, we have these urinals, and these are really nice. They have these dividers between them. It's really nice. It's private. But sometimes, like if you go to the football game or something, it's got a big hog trough we all belly up to, you know. This is a hog trough night. And this guy comes in, and he takes out what appears to be the world's smallest baby spoon. And I'm fascinated. And I start to watch him, and he takes this baby spoon out, and he begins to put things up his nose. And I'm fascinated, man. Well, ladies, the men will testify to this, and they'll tell you straight up here tonight, whatever you do if you're in a men's restroom, don't get caught looking at the guy next to you. He caught me. I'm a real live alcoholic. You need to understand, I drink every time I want. When my mind says drink, we drink. But I'm going to tell you something. When a guy like me begins to drink, different cat begins to call the shots in my life. I can have all kind of what the book describes as moral and philosophical values, you know. But I can say, just say no, you know. I can tell you, man, I'm the drinker, but I'm never doing drugs. I'm never doing any of that stuff. I'll smoke a little reefer with you, but I'm talking about drugs, you know. I mean, real drugs. And this guy's got real drugs. I mean, I'm watching him put it up his nose. But see, what I don't know then, but what I do know today, is my whole life is run by fear. My whole life I've been looking for it. I don't know that. This hole that is where the cold wind that Corbin described is 15 minutes late. You know, the need to be somewhere else as fast as I can get there. I'm looking for it. That your house, your car, your parents, your wife, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, whatever. If I had that, I'm going to be okay. I'm looking for it. I don't know that. And I'm afraid everywhere I go that you're going to not like me or you're going to like me. Just come here or go away. You know, I just absolutely, my whole life is dictated by fear. I have no clue about that. But on that particular night in that bathroom, that guy caught me and he dipped in that and he started going towards my nose in the 2 seconds, probably from the time he caught me, that he moved that spoon from his vial to my nose. All these thoughts began to run through my head. But the critical thought that ran through my head that night was, what will this guy think of me if I don't do that? What will he think of me if I don't do it? Because I'm dominated by fear. And so I just took a big whiff. And he put one on my other nostril. I took another big whiff. And so I need to describe for you exactly what happened on that night. Every time that cat went to the bathroom, I followed him in there. That's what happened. But I found a cure for the blackouts, man. You know. You need to know I was the unpaid night watchman in my neighborhood for a number of years. You know? You want to catch me, come about 3 in the morning. I got blind cuts on me, man, from watching out, you know. Looking for the tree people. I know there's some tree people here. I know there are. Yeah, you're here. You know. That's Gatorade for the drinking, man. That's what cocaine is, man. So anyway. But I found a cure for the blackouts. And that really ramped up my drinking. You know, the book says, it says that here are some of the methods we've tried. And it says we'll go to that ad infinitum. That means we can't even get a list big enough for that. And that worked for me. It was a design to manage and control my alcoholism. I went to my first treatment center in 1988. I had some friends from law school show up and said, we know what you're doing and you're out of control. And I'm going to tell you, at that time, hostage number two had been set free. And I was living in Norman, Oklahoma, and I was 28 years old. I was a named partner in a major law firm in Oklahoma City, the youngest named partner in Oklahoma City. And I represented Fortune 500 companies. By this time, I was trying jury trials by myself with some success. And I had arrived. And I'm going to tell you, I thought, when I be able to do all this, this will be it. And I got to tell you, that wasn't it. It wasn't it. And but they thought I needed to go to treatment, or they were going to get my license jerked, so I'm no dummy. I went to treatment. I spent 30 days in the treatment center in beautiful Tucson, Arizona. And I got a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I still have it at home. I showed it to my sponsor when I really got sober, and he said, that one didn't work. We need to get another one, so I did. And I got highlights in it, you know, but it really looks like my high school yearbook because everybody signed it. You know, when you leave treatment, it's like graduating high school. You'll do great, you know. Now, I wasn't the president like Corbin, but I was the most likely to succeed. That's what I was. So, and they told me I need to go home and go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me tell you something. There's a significant difference between a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and a home group. I belong to a home group. It's called the Altered Boys in Oklahoma City. We meet on Wednesday night in a basement of a church. It's a closed meeting. God's an alcoholic because he shows up at our closed meeting, so I know he's an alcoholic, you know. It's a closed meeting in a basement of a church. We meet one night a week on Wednesday nights. The other six nights of the week, we're out in wind-up joints. You know, places we wind up. Prisons, detoxes, jails, treatment centers. The other six nights of the week, we're carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to those places. And I'm going to tell you, in my home group, and I know there's some good home group members here, if you're a member of a good home group, what happens is I'm accountable to those people. But if I'm not there on Wednesday night, somebody's calling me and going, where are you? And I'm going to tell you, as a member of that home group, I have a commitment there. And if I'm obligated to fulfill my commitment, I have some bond to that group. Now, in Oklahoma City, there's 1,000 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every month. And I can become really anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can, because I have no accountability. I'll float in. I'm a helicopter. You know, I come in and I hover over a seat. I'm gone, you know. And I become real anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll die, a real alcoholic of my type. Of the hopeless variety, which the book describes as I can't drink and I can't not drink, that hopeless variety will die in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we talk about the still suffered alcoholic in here, it's not necessarily the person that's out on the street. The still suffering alcoholic, I promise you, I will guarantee you, is right here tonight. And it may be somebody not with 30 days or 6 months, but it's going to be somebody with 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 25 years here tonight. And the trick's going to be they've gone back to sleep. And they know the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they can't remember the tune. And the music plays for them, but they just can't remember the tune. And the trick in Alcoholics Anonymous and what we're here for and what Alcoholics Anonymous promises in our 12th step is that if we do certain things, we're going to have a spiritual awakening. We come awake. The trick here is to stay awake. The absolute trick in Alcoholics Anonymous is once you're here and had an awakening, to stay awake. And how do you do that? You go to them wind-up joints. You go carry this message. In this book, carry this message to those places, and you tell those people about the good news of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a good home group has commitments like that, and I'm obligated, and I'm a member of a good home group. But when I got out of treatment in 1988, I floated into one of those open topic discussion meetings, which my sponsor today finally calls wrist slasher meetings, you know, which you can go into and learn a lot about pet care, relationship advice, but you get no information about how to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I was sitting in those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there would be people in there with a solution. And I'm going to tell you, good meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where people share the solution out of this book, share the solution that Bill Wilson found in 1934 in the hospital bed in Towns Hospital, that solution. When people share that solution in good meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's palpable. It's palpable. And you can feel the electricity around the room. You can feel that presence of that power in the room, and it just pops around. But I'm an AA vampire, man. You guys talked about action. That sounded like something kind of work. I don't want nothing to do with that. I'm here because they said I might lose my bar license. That's the only reason I'm here. They didn't say nothing about this other stuff. And I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a taker, and I take, and I take, and I take. I found another hostage. We produced a hostage yet. And I told people today in a sponsorship me, I used to be against that he and she and Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I realized we're saving two normal people. That's probably a good thing. So just whatever. Guilty over there, man. So anyway. So I just said in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a taker. I'm a vampire. Just suck the life out of you, man. And what happened is I came back from that treatment center, I sat in AA, and my life got better than it was before I left. And I thought, this is it. If I get this, it'll be it. And I had, now I wasn't just a name partner, I was a first name partner in the 30-man law firm in downtown Oklahoma City. I had 45 employees that reported directly to me, and I was somebody. And I got loose from you people. I'm in Dallas, Texas, and I'm with some clients doing a really big deal down there because I'm a big shot. What I've discovered, a big shot, that's just a squirt under pressure. That's all that is, you know. And so I'm a big shot in Dallas, you know. I'm doing some big deal. And the waitress comes around. We're having a steak dinner. She said, would you gentlemen like a glass of wine with your steaks? And I said, yes, I would. And I had that glass of wine, and I sat there that night on the way back to my car. I said, see, I'm not alcoholic. Not alcoholic. Had some bad luck in the trouble in the 80s, but hell, who didn't? You know, but this is the 90s. Just say no, man. So that's what I'm about. That was in August of 1993, and I got my car, drove back to Oklahoma City. I was going to get my social life cranked back up. And in December of that year, in 1993, I came home 2 days before Christmas, and I went to the kitchen. I tore off 7 black garbage bags, and I went back to my room, and I began to fill it with everything that was important to me. My little girl was 3 years old at that time, and she was hanging on my leg saying, Daddy, please don't go, please don't go. I don't know where alcohol takes you. I don't know where your alcoholism does to you. I just know what it does to me. When my mind says drink, we drink. And I stepped right over that little girl because, see, I'll step over anything to satisfy the obsession in my mind. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for as long as I can remember, I've had this picture of what my life should look like. And I've tried my best to make that picture work. Those are called old ideas. And I believe when there's a lot of people that come to Alcoholics that are just like me, they come here and they have this picture about what their life should look like, because they know best. They still want to hang on to some modicum of control over here, as if I ever had it. And I have an idea about what that looks like. Now, what the book tells me is I'll try to wrest satisfaction out of life to make it match this picture, this idea I have. The trouble is it's an unsatisfied. The ego is never satisfied. No matter what I do, the picture never looks right. You people always move around on me, you know, and the picture never looks right. And I'll try harder, and it's just never quite right. And just when I think I've got it, it moves on me. And I'm going to tell you, I began to spiral out of control, and that law firm, I quit going to work. I quit showing up for court. The judges would call my office, say, where is he? Where is he? And they would cover for me. And I'm going to tell you, I would tell people I never had really any consequences before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And by consequences to me is if I went to federal prison. See, that would be a consequence. Losing families and stuff like that, that was just life. That's just what happened. You know. And you'll have people who will stand behind this podium and they'll tell you, I lost this and I lost that. Let me tell you something. Cliff never lost anything in his whole life. If I tell you I've lost something, that implies that later on this evening, I may go outside and kick a rock and find it. What I need you to know is this, is I've traded everything that was valuable and important in my life. I gave it away. to live the kind of life that my mind demanded that I live. I was driven, what the book says, by an obsession to make this picture work. And I know if I can just get the formula right, I can just get this ache to stop, and this will be okay. If I can just get it to come together, it'll be all right. One more family I lost. One more family got set free. And I just began to spiral out of control. My legal assistant had a key to my house, and he would come, and he would have to wake me up out of a drunk to get me to sign papers, having no idea what I was signing. I'm going to tell you, when the rainmaker quits making rain, all the crops dry up. And I got evicted from that building. Now, I'd like to tell you that, you know, my lease came due, and they said, you know, Cliff, it might be a better idea if you move somewhere else, you know. But what happened was that I can't pay the rent, and I got evicted from that building. And I'm the kind of alcoholic that say this, is that my drinking never hurt anybody. But I'm going to tell you something. On that day, 45 families lost their job like that. But see, I never hurt anybody. My drinking never hurt anybody. That's the delusion that I live in. That's what the illness does to a guy like me. I live in this delusional thinking. I just am so selfish and self-consumed. I don't see that my actions hurt anybody else. And I spiral out of control. In the last 3 years of my drinking, I never drew a sober breath. In the mix of all that, I met Lori. Just before I spiraled out of control, I met Lori in 1995. And, man, it was just, I'm going to tell you, you guys heard her story, who are here today and heard her story. She is the best thing that has ever come into my life besides God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love her with everything, all my fiber and all my being. And I'm going to tell you, as much as I love her and as much as I love that little girl and I love her little boy, I could not stop drinking. I cannot stop. It doesn't matter how great that was, it wasn't enough. It's never been enough. And I spiral out of control, and she began to run me around to try to get me fixed. And she ran me to one psychiatrist, and she was in Al-Anon. Now, I didn't know what that was at the time. I didn't know she was in Al-Anon. If you're thinking about going out or going to a psychiatrist, talk to them, get to figure it out a little bit, what they're about, you know, before you go. You know, but she figured me out on the second visit. And she'd given Lori these sleeping pills. And she said, give him one at 5. If he's still awake at 10, give him another one. Now, what I heard her say is, Cliff, we're going to have to triple up on everything we're doing to beat this deal, you know. And I've had a lot of blackouts in my life. I had some kind of schizophrenic whiteout this night, man. I just, boom, you know. And this is what it looked like. On June 30th of 2001, this is the scene. I barricaded myself into a room. My wife breaks in. And what she sees is I'm naked to the world. There's a blue screen on the television set, which I have pulled right up next to the bed where the adult videos have ran out. There's an empty quart of vodka. There's an empty quart of wine. There's a little baggie with some white substance in it. And she hit me like I'd been shot out of a cannon. And she shook that bag of dopamine. She said, what the hell is this? Now, what I want to tell you good people is this. That prior to my drinking career overtaking my legal career, I'd probably tried 50 or so jury trials with some success. And you know, when you're trying jury trials, what you're doing is you want to put forth a set of facts to the benefit of your client and present them in such a way that at the end of the trial, you get up and argue your theory of the facts sufficiently so that the jury, generally 12 men or women or less, will find in favor of your client. And I know how to make those kind of arguments, but on that morning when she hit me with that bag of dope and she said, what the hell is this? The best argument I had for that morning was, I don't know. I think them people barricaded me in here and dropped that on the way out. Best I can tell, man. There was some discussion went on about whose house it was, and come to find out on that day it was more her house than mine, you know. But I'm grateful for that, because on June 30th of 2001, that's when I came back to you. Now, I didn't come back to you because I wanted to get sober. Don't be mistaken about that. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous with any kind of good motives, whatever those mean, for any good reason to be here, whatever that means. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on June 30th, 2001 for one reason and one reason only, get back in the house. And see, I believe this, it doesn't really matter why you come here. It doesn't really matter why you come here. I've met a couple of people here this weekend. I met a young lady this morning at the end of the workshop that Bill and I did this morning, and I met another who had like 13 or 14 days sober, and I met another young lady over here this afternoon. We were getting coffee and tea over here at the hotel, and she had like 9 months, and you gotta fight for that. You gotta fight, you gotta wanna be sober. You gotta wanna be sober. And if you're here today and you're under a year, you got a shot. You got a shot, man. Because it doesn't make any difference why you're here. It's my experience at Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I've never met anybody that said, you know, I was sitting home, life was good. All my checks were cashing. Wife's happy. Husband's happy. I thought, what the hell? Let's check out AA. Let's just go see what they do down there. Because my life's good. They just probably had to. My experience is people get here because they burn their life to the ground. And they've got nowhere else to go. If you're new here tonight, if you don't hear anything else, hear this. You are wanted, welcomed, and needed here. You're wanted, welcomed, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because one reason, I want to get back in the house. Maybe back in the big bed. I don't know, maybe some crossover privileges every once in a while, you know? A guy can dream, can he? You know? But I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat there for 45 days, and I had one thought only, how do I drink and how do I stay sober? You know, how do I drink and how do I stay sober? How can I beat the physical, you know, the laws of physics and stay sober and drink at the same time? If you're new here today and you're trying to figure that out, I'll save you some time. You can't do that, you know. It is a physical impossibility to drink and stay sober, you know, if you're an alcoholic of my type. You know. But that was what I would think. How do I drink and how do I stay sober? And it seemed to me that on those 45 days that I was there, that all of Charlie Brown's people showed up every damn day. You know, womp, 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 womp. And then you guys would hold hands and you would pray and chant and hit me with a lightning, God, maybe I'll get sober, whatever you say. And boom, I'm out the door, you know. But I'm going to tell you, for 45 days there had been an old man there. And every day that old man would catch me at the door. There was two doors in and out of that meeting. And every day it seemed that he would position himself that he was going to get me. Yeah. And every day, as I'm heading out the door, he would stop me and he'd say, Bub, how are you doing? And I would give him the same BS drunk answer every day, fine. I'm fine. And he would say, well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And I said, boy, Don, if there is, I will. Ghost. I'm gone. 45 days that old man did that. And I'm sitting there in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just, I'm going to tell you, you separate me from alcohol, I go nuts. You know, book says I've got two choices. Chase it to the bitter end or accept spiritual health. That's it. Help. That's it. And I'm sitting there, how do I drink? How do I stay sober? And I did that all I could. And finally, I just had to go drink. And I came home on Thursday and I left and I came home on Sunday because that's what I do. Somebody asked me one time at one of these talks, they asked me about that. They said, how long did that you do that, Cliff? I said, 2-4 wives. That's how long I did that, you know. But I just left. And I came back home and Lori caught me at the door. She said, you've been drinking? I said, no, I haven't. She said, well, let's do a drug test. And I began to negotiate for time. Because, you know, time's your friend on that stuff. You know, if I could get 2 days, I'm good, you know. And I got invited to leave the house again. And on August the 15th of 2001, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat down. I did not know it was going to be the day that I sat down in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I sat down that day. And people talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about the committee in their head. Man, mine was a full-bore stockholders meeting. You know, it was a scene out of Wall Street with Michael Douglas, you know, with everybody screaming and it's all going. If I could have got it to a committee, it would have been manageable. You know? But there's 20 minutes left of that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all Charlie Brown's people are there. And there's 20 minutes left, and my head goes stone cold quiet. You talk about scary. And a thought came to me. And this is just not a thought that originated in me, and I know that today. And the thought was this: if you don't do something different today, you're going to die. And I hung on to that thought. And that meeting was over, and you people prayed and said, "Hope lightning hits you and God helps you," and whatever it is you say. And I broke for the door. And on the 45th day, Don Cone caught me at that door. And he said, "Bub, how are you doing?" And on that day, I gave him a different answer. I said, "I'm not doing good at all, Don." He said, "I know." Kreskin. He said, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do to help you, let me know." And I said, "Man, I really need a sponsor." Now, I ended that with a period, but Don was old, and he thought it was a question mark, apparently. And he said, "That's a lot to ask of somebody. Let's sit down here and talk about that." And Don sat down, and he began to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he began to talk to me about his drinking. And I've been around AA. You know, I've never been in AA. I've been around AA. But Don was 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was 65 years old. And he said, and he talked to me about his drinking. He talked to me about how he felt. And I'm sure somebody had done that to me before. I'm sure somebody had talked to me about that. I'm sure a treatment they did. But I'm going to tell you the cunning feature of alcoholism. Until you know you got it, you don't have it. And all this other information you'll give a person like that is useless. Because if I don't believe I have it, there's no reason for me to retain any of that. Because it doesn't apply to me. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they'd say, you just got to quit drinking for the rest of your life. And I was 28 years old. I was looking at those people. They were like 5 years younger than I am now. And I thought, well, hell, that may be tomorrow for you. But I'm 28. That ain't me. But I'm going to tell you, I needed Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 16 years old. And by the time I got to you people, and by the time Don set me down and gave me a presentation, you know, the book says circumstances make us willing. You know, see, it's not my job. What Don taught me, it's not my job to convince any person on this earth they belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to come by and tell you that, listen, if you relapse, you just need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You need to do this. You need to do that. I don't need to tell anybody about that. That's Whiskey's job. Until Whiskey convinces you, you belong here, and you become willing to do something different. See, there's a bottom that happens here. The deal is you got to be able to survive the bottom. And we all know this for a fact. There's a lot of people hit a bottom, never survive that. They never survive them. What really a bottom does for us, it gets us to a point. It gets me to a point where I become willing to do something else. Because see, the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, for a real alcoholic of my type, there's a moment in time, and it happened to me when that thought came to me, there's a moment in time for each and every alcoholic when God cracks our heart and He allows us to stand in that valley. And He gives us an opportunity to see ourselves exactly who and what we are. And in that moment in time, in that moment when that heart cracks and God holds up that mirror where we can see what is, it absolutely has to be followed up by immediate action. Because if it doesn't, what happens? The first step in Alcoholics Anonymous becomes just another bad day in the life of a drunk. Just one more bad day. That moment in time when it's cracked and God shows me who I am, if something gets in there and gets me into action, I've got a shot. That's what Don did for me. And he talked to me that day about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to nod my head. And the more I nodded my head, it seemed that fangs began to grow out of his mouth. You know? And he said, "Let me tell you something, Cliff." He said, "Around here, we have a lot of suggestions." He said, "Those will kill an alcoholic like you." He said, "You need requirements." He said, "I've got three for you." And he seemed really nice, you know, initially. He said, "The first thing is you're going to call me every day. You got a phone?" And I had a phone because Lori was the only one working at the time. I didn't work the last 3 years of my drinking, you know. I like to describe it as I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife that worked, you know. I was a real go-getter. Take her to work and go get her. That's what I do, so. He said, you got a phone? I pulled out this flip phone that she was still paying for. And he said, put my number in there. I'm going to tell you, I call that old man every day. Don died about 12 years ago on me without my permission. I've got another sponsor today. Before Don was taken out of that room, before he left the room, when I knew he died, before they came to get him to haul him off, I had another sponsor. Somebody asked me one time, said, Cliff, don't you think that was a great disrespect to Don to have another sponsor before he assumed room temperature? I said, no, don't be mistaken. You know, the greatest disservice, the most disloyalty I could be to Don Cohen was not have another sponsor as soon as I knew he was gone. Because what Don knew is that I didn't need to be roaming the earth without adult supervision. That's for sure. So I call that old man every day. I call Jimmy Jack now every day. I just started calling him. He didn't ask me to. I just called him because that's what I know. Because Don never said, quit calling me. Let's call him. He said, you need to be in a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous every day. Well, I ain't worked in 3 years. I had to think about that. I'm pretty busy. I got some underwear drawers to straighten, some socks to fold, you know. Busy. And he said, but you don't know where the good meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are, so I'm going to come get you and I'm going to take you where they are because you need to go where big book studies are. You need to go where literature-based meetings are. And he just set me up a milk route, you know. Just a milk route, here on Mondays, here on Tuesdays, here on Thursdays. And he said, you know, I'll come get you and we'll just do the milk route. He had a home group that met and we did that on Sunday nights. And Don began to get me the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, here's the third requirement. He said, it's a deal breaker. He said, whenever I ask you to do something, you don't need to come back tomorrow and share how that makes you feel. He said, I don't need your input. He says, as a matter of fact, I don't need nothing from you. He said, but whenever I ask you to do something, you're going to agree to do that. And if you can't agree to this, I can't help you. And he made that little feint like he was getting up, and that terrified me. And I agreed to that, you know. And oddly enough, from that moment in time to this moment in time right here, I haven't found it necessary to drink, you know. And the point of all that is our first step talks about this powerless and unmanaged building. Second step talks about hope, and that's what Don gave me on today. Because he talked about being a recovered alcoholic, which is what our literature says we become here. You know, restored to some kind of health here. That hopeless state of mind and body. Don talked about being recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he began to get me in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you, we just had an adventure together in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd go to Don's house on Monday night. We'd read the book. He would tell me about the book. He would explain the book to me. He'd ask me questions. And I would identify, begin to identify in the doctor's opinion, Bill's story. And 30 days sober, and Lori came to me and she said, Cliff, we're having a deal at the church, the history of the Catholic Church. I'd like for you to go with me. And it was on Sunday nights. My home group met on Sunday nights. At 5:30, this deal was at 5:30. I said, well, honey, I can't go. It's a home group night, and I got a commitment. She said, I appreciate that. I just wanted you to know you was invited. And so the next day, I'm talking to Don. And I'm telling him the problems in my universe at that time. And I tell him about Lori and wanting me to go do this, but it's home group night. And of course, I told her I couldn't because I've got a commitment and with the home group. And what I want Don to say is, my God, I'm pretty sure we can advance you a couple of days. I don't know that I've ever had a sponsoree that followed direction quite as close as you do. Matter of fact, next meeting, we're just going to stand you up, and I'm just going to tell them, hey, we're advancing Cliff 2 days. I've never had anybody do as well as he has. But that's not what he said. I got all the way through that, and he goes, go back to what Lori wants to do. And I thought, man, he really is old. He's already forgot. So I went back and reviewed with him. Sunday night, home group, church, history, can't go, commitment. And he said, boy, that's where you got it all wrong. And he said, that woman saved your life. And if that's what she wants to do, we're going to do that. Now, he said we, but I knew that meant me. You know, I wasn't that delusional. Now, what Don wanted to do for me that day, he wanted to teach me about my selfishness. And what he wanted to teach me is that to go to Lori and do something that she wanted to do and be giving for her. That was the lesson. Don had no idea what was going to happen to me. He had no idea. That's why sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is critical today. If you're like me, I sit around and talk about all the problems in AA. You like that? I judge AA all the time. Yeah. Well, it's fun. Yeah, first of all. And I just judge it all the time. But sponsorship is so incredibly important here. And if you want to talk about AA, and you want to judge AA, and you want to talk about how incredibly poor it is or whatever, you can trace all that back to sponsorship. Everything. Every problem you think Alcoholics Anonymous has? Sponsorship. Everything you complain about your home group? Sponsorship. Everything you think's wrong with Alcoholics Anonymous? Sponsorship. Because that's where it all starts. But Don was a strong sponsor. He told me, you know, you're going to have commitments and requirements. And he taught me lessons. And he taught me lessons mostly by showing me. Because our book talks about demonstrations. Because I would much rather see a sermon than hear one. And he gave me plenty to see. But I go back to Lori and I said, Lori, I've been thinking about it and I think I can go with you on Sunday night. And she said, that's great. So I went with her on Sunday night and I was at the second Sunday. It was a 2-hour deal. It was the second Sunday, second hour. There was a break for snacks. I was big on that. And I went and got this old priest that taught this class. His name was Father Mollen. God rest his soul. I got to go to his wake. I'm forever grateful for him. And Father Mollen, at the beginning of every one of these sessions, he would tell a joke. And they were corny. And nobody would laugh at me because I'm 30 days sober. Hell, it's all funny to me, you know. Then I'd go to sleep because it's comfortable and I'm full. But on this particular night, he began to tell a story and I thought it was a joke, so I listened. He said, well, I grew up in Chicago and where I went to play with my friends and where I went to school and did everything from the time I was like 6 years old on. He said, I had to cross the cemetery. He said, of course, that was no big deal, except at night. He said, at night, when I was a little boy, I would come to the edge of that cemetery on my way home. And he said, I would stand on the edge of that cemetery and in my mind's eye, I would imagine dead people coming out of the ground. The trees were monsters. You know, he said, man, I would just take off scared to death, running through that cemetery, hoping nothing was going to get me. He said, but you know, if I ever got caught on the other side of that cemetery at night and my daddy was with me, he said, you know, when I would just put my hand in my daddy's hand, puff my chest out, and walk through that cemetery knowing for a fact that everything was going to be all right. And I swear to God, he looked right at me and he said, that's how God is. And for the very first time in my life, I heard that. And then he said, you know what? God is your number one fan. And I heard that too. If you're sitting here tonight, and when I say the word God, whatever comes to your mind, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm going to tell you, I left that night and I went home and the next night I went to Don's house and I talked to him about that and I told him and he looked at me and he said, is that a conception that you can believe in? And I'm going to tell you, that little conception, that simple idea, our book talks about simple ideas in step 3. It talks about the employer, the employee, the parent, the child, the director, the actor. It used to say in our basic text, in the very when it was first being published, before they went to print, it had one little statement in that where it was talking about those things. It says, get this simple idea straight. You know, they didn't mince words. Get this simple idea straight. And I went to Don that night, and I told him about that, and he kicked the ottoman out and he got down. He broke out the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Said, get on your knees with me. He said, do you know the third step prayer? But I didn't. And he said, well, let's say it together. Now, Don had been, that home group I told you Don had been going to, every meeting they opened it with the serenity prayer and the third step prayer. Don had been a member there for 10 years by the time I got to him. Let's say he went 50 times a year and he'd been there 50, you know, he'd been going for 10 years. That's 500 times he had recited. If that's all he ever did, once a week he had recited the third step prayer 500 times. Don knew the prayer. But on that night he got the book out and he put it down and he got on his knees with me and he read the prayer with me out of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that didn't resonate with me at the time. But we have a deal in Alcoholics Anonymous that we walk shoulder to shoulder with the new man. That no one's here any better or any worse. The man with 51 years and the man with 2 days, they have every much right to say here as anybody else in this room.
Don was always giving me demonstrations that all night at 10 years and 30 days that he was equal to me, and he was willing to get on his knees and read the prayer with me to show me he wasn't no big deal. He gave me a demonstration of these principles. And my life in Alcoholics Anonymous has been like that. People me giving me demonstrations about how my life should be lived. People seemingly unqualified to give it to me. Giving me direction on how to live my life. And this idea that I had, this picture that I had about how it should look. You know, when I said that prayer with Don and began to take principled actions in my life, what I discovered was I had finally found it. And it had been with me just like the book said. It had been with me all the time. For deep down inside, every man, woman, and child, of course, is the fundamental idea of God. And it had been there all the time. Sure, it had been covered up by pomp, circumstances, worship of other things. But there in the final analysis, there it was. And that idea of this power greater than myself, this God idea, was as much a part of me as a long-lost friend. And I began to operate in Alcoholics Anonymous with a whole other set of ideas. And one day my thinking was this way, and the next day it was something totally different. A wholesale miracle had taken place in my life. And I suddenly began to be satisfied with everything around me. This notion of restless, irritable discontent seemed to begin to dissipate away from me. And the more I took the steps and worked with other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the better my life seemed to be. And the busier my life seemed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, the better my life seemed to be at home. And the more that I did in Alcoholics Anonymous, it seemed the more time I had to do the other things that were important in my life, like go to work. You know? It's interesting to tell you that building that I got kicked out of 3 years into sobriety, I went and made amends with those people and moved back in that same building. I'm still there today. You know, in that same building I got evicted of. See, what we have here is really spiritual arithmetic. It's addition by subtraction. I have to be willing to certain things to be able to subtract, allow God to subtract from my life so that He can put the other good stuff in my life back into it. And this picture that I've had all my life, what happened is I had to get an old man in my life to give me motiveless direction. That he had no vested interest in me other than my well-being. And what Don saw for me in the very first day I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous was not a hopeless, helpless drunk. He saw in me what I could be with God's help. He saw what I could be. And he would give me direction that I would think doesn't look anything about how this picture is supposed to look. It's not going to turn out any way the way I want this picture to look for me. But through motiveless direction, because he loved me and because he cared about me, what began to happen over time was that my life began to get into order. And I began to be reasonably happy. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason and one reason only. Because I wanted to get back in the house. That's the only reason I came here. And here we are in October in Athens, Georgia. You know, the sign of God is that you'll be led where you did not plan to go. I'm telling you. The day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't say, "Now let me get my calendar out." I'm pretty sure in 2018 I got to be in Athens, Georgia, you know. God will lead you where you did not plan to go. You know. And my life has grown, and my life in Alcoholics Anonymous has grown. And there's nothing more I like better than to set somebody across the table for me in this book and in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there's nothing quite like when the lights come on. It's better than any drunk, it's better than any high, it's better than anything I've ever done. There's nothing I can tell you I love more to be sitting to me in Alcoholics Anonymous and watch the people in my life and listen to them share and have a front row seat in absolutely the greatest show on earth. Absolutely the greatest show on earth. And watch this wholesale miracle that has happened to me. And I can guarantee you this, if you're here tonight, and I don't care if you're here for 2 days, 50 years, or somewhere in between, if you're here tonight and you have this idea, but Yacliff, you don't understand. Man, I'm in a dark hole. I'm in a spot. I'm in a place that I've slid to. I've been here, man, but I'm just down in this place. And I'm going to tell you this, what my friend Paul from New York says. If you're in a hole, if you're in a spot, you're really only 12 steps away. You're 12 steps away from having the life of your wildest dreams. The life of your wildest dreams. And what I'm going to tell you today is finally, I've got something between me and the drink. There's something today between the drink and the drink. The book says the problem will be removed, and it has been. It absolutely has been removed from me, and it's been removed from many of my friends. There was a little boy, and one day he was out running, and he saw a sign, and the sign said, puppies for sale. And this little boy just took off running to the address listed on the sign. And he ran up to this old farmer's house, and the farmer was out that day. And he ran up and he said, Mister, I want to buy a puppy. And the old farmer looked down at the kid and he said, well, kid, these are expensive dogs. You know, these just ain't regular dogs. These are expensive. These are show dogs. He said, you got to have some money to buy these. He said, how much money you got? He goes, 57 cents. He said, well, it's going to take more than that. He said, well, how much to look at them? He said, 57 cents. And the boy gave him the money. Come on, Ginger. And the mama dog come out of the little house, down the ramp. And four little fuzzballs, boom, 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 bounced down the ramp behind her. And they was out playing and running around. And boy, the boy leaned into the fence and his eyes just lit up, you know. Just lit up. And then out of the corner of his eye, he caught something. Another commotion over here in the house. Another little fuzzball, not as big as the others. Slid down, didn't run down, he slid down. Smaller than the other dogs, they began to butt him around and roll him around. And then the little boy just leaned in further and he said, that's him right there, mister. That's the one. That's him right there. And the old farmer just hunched down, eye to eyeball with the little boy. He said, oh son, you don't want that dog. He said, that's a runt. He's a cripple. Well, he's never going to be able to run and play with you like these other dogs do. And the little boy took one step backwards and pulled up both of his britches legs. And down each side of his legs ran two metal poles. He said, that's okay. See, I don't run so good either. And he's going to need somebody who'll understand. And the old farmer stood up and he reached in the kennel and he picked up the little dog and he handed it to him. He said, here you go, son. He said, how much, mister? He said, paid in full. He said, your love will be enough. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, busted, broken, and an old man stood by the door. An old man stood by the door, and his love was enough. His love was enough. One day this power, this God of my understanding, I believe this with all my heart. There'll be a time when I'll stand with that power. And it's going to have one question and one question only for me. And that's going to be this. Is it's going to be clip on August the 15th of 2001. I gave you a gift. What did you do with it? Thanks for having me.